Welcome to the FDD Events Podcast. I'm Cliff Mate, founder and president of FDD, and pleased to share with you the following conversation. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss out on future FDD events.
Good morning. It's Monday, March 25th. The war in the Middle East is now 171 days old. I'm Jonathan Schanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. Sometimes wars pause because of the weather. Sometimes wars pause because of major moments on the battlefield. This war in Gaza has been paused for political reasons, and it's increasingly bizarre to watch. The tension is building on both sides of the Atlantic, and we will continue to try to make sense of it all to the extent that anyone can here at the FDD Morning Brief. So keep tuning in. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by my colleague, Mark Montgomery. Monty, as he is known to all of us, is a retired Rear Admiral in the United States Navy. I'll warn you now that he sometimes can't help himself. He does occasionally curse like a sailor, which he is. But he knows a ton about a ton of things, and one of those things is cyber warfare. In fact, he's Senior Director of FDD Center on Cyber and Technology Innovation, otherwise known as CCTI. But before we turn to Monty, I want to talk about that ISIS attack in Moscow. First, let's acknowledge that the attack was heinous. It has been condemned by those who deplore Vladimir Putin, and for good reason. It was a vicious terrorist attack, and those acts must be condemned. But when the news first broke, the first thing I thought about was the 10/7 massacre. Similarly brutal, hard to ignore. The second thing I thought of was that after 20 years since the 9/11 attacks, more than 20 years, the war on terrorism is not over. It never ended. But perhaps a decade ago, the powers that be in Washington determined that it was time to pivot away from the Middle East, and so pivot we did to engage in what we call great power competition. That means that we want to make sure that China and Russia don't eclipse us or undermine the US-led world order, a laudable goal. Except terrorism continues to plague the West. But not just the West. Heck, ISIS just attacked Russia. And before that, just a few months ago, ISIS also targeted Iran. These are US adversaries. Did ISIS switch sides here? And if so, why? And why are the revisionist powers not doing more in response? I don't know how to interpret all of this, but I'll just say this. The world has gotten more and more complicated. I'd personally welcome someone, anyone, who could explain to me exactly how to interpret the behaviors of our adversaries right now. I also wouldn't mind if someone could explain what our policy is toward our friends. Amidst all of this chaos, it appears that only one country is taking the biggest and most sustained beating from the international community. Do I need to say out loud which one? Of course I don't. Now for your headlines. Headline one, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, aligned with the Fatah faction, are all fighting Israel at the Shifa Hospital. That's pretty much everyone. They're fighting together and separately, and they have one mission, to try to kill Israelis, except they are not succeeding. The Israelis have lost only two fighters in recent days while capturing and killing hundreds of terrorists. I would say this is progress, even though there is an attempt to challenge the progress that Israel has made in northern Gaza. But let me also remind you, there was a time when the media here bizarrely tried to deny that Shifa was a major center of terrorist activity in Gaza. Today, it's undeniable. It is a headquarters for Hamas, maybe more than that. And the recent surge in activity around Gaza's most notorious hospital is a clear indication of that. I'm glad we're no longer debating this. Headline two, the UN is set to vote on a ceasefire in the Gaza war for the remainder of Ramadan. The resolution is not an American one. This is Russian and Chinese, but the optics are funky because this is what the Biden administration has been angling for, except for two problems. One, this is a resolution tabled by our adversaries. And two, it would gift Hamas a ceasefire while yielding nothing in return for Israel. I'm sure the White House is tempted, but we are several weeks into intense negotiations for a hostage deal. The Israelis have agreed to an outrageous 800 hardened Hamas prisoners in exchange for 40 Israelis held in captivity. We're waiting for the Hamas response. This UN resolution gives Hamas an ace in the hole. In my view, the Biden administration has very little choice but to reject this. And headline three. A former Israeli officer claims that a State Department official accuses Israel of sexual crimes against the Palestinians. This is quite a serious accusation. It comes after months of international indifference to the rape and sexual abuse of Israeli women at the hands of Hamas on October 7th, 2023. To hear this now from a State Department official and to not see the substantiation behind it, that does not sit well with me. To be clear, there could be an incident we don't know about, maybe several incidents, and the culprits would need to be held to account if the facts bear out. But the rape of multiple women on 10/7 was systematic and it was undeniable. And that has yet to be fully acknowledged by the international community. And in the meantime, it appears that the Qatari-owned Al Jazeera television network was responsible for producing this accusation. Anyone surprised? I'm not. I'm just surprised that anyone at the State Department would parrot such a serious accusation from a media outlet owned by a Hamas patron without doing some serious fact-checking first. Now for our discussion with Mark Montgomery. As I said, he's a retired Rear Admiral in the U.S. Navy. He's a top FDD cyber expert, and he's got a lot to say about what's been happening in the Middle East since the war erupted last year. We're thrilled he's joined us live today for the FDD Morning Brief. Welcome, Mark Montgomery.
Good morning, John.
Well, thanks for joining us today. Let me start with this. You and our FDD colleague, Annie Fixler, just published a piece in the New York Post on Iran's role in cyber support for Hamas actions against Israel since October 7th. If you would, just tell us a little bit about Iran's cyber capabilities and then maybe also just tell us what they've been up to in recent months.
Yeah, thank you. And Annie and I did a piece on that. She's obviously one of our top researchers here. Iran, when you look at it, there's four countries, adversaries or countries of concern in cyber: China, Russia, North Korea, Iran. We've kind of been North Korea and Iran together, but that's not fair. They're two very different things. North Korea is like a cyber criminal gang masquerading as a nation state. I'll set them aside. Iran's a much more complex challenge. You know, they use their cyber for a lot of different tools. They use it to suppress internal dissent very effectively. They use it to attack their international diaspora and try to knock down any criticism abroad. But then they also use it pretty aggressively over the last 8 years against Israel and its critical infrastructure. There was a water attack in 2020 that not successful, but could have had significant consequences. And we're finally starting to see them attack the United States and our critical infrastructure. And we can talk about that in a little bit. But really what our article was about how they've also repositioned it to support some of their proxy groups. And we have seen this very aggressively after October 7th with support to Hamas. And what they've been doing is first, again, attacking Israel, which we would expect. Web attempts at website defacements, attempts at disruption. They've been largely unsuccessful there. They have done a lot of disinformation where they put false stories into the Israeli social media. So like of a successful attack on Dimona, things like that. But then they've been doing work masquerading as the Al-Qassam Brigade. In other words, they're actually, who doesn't have this kind of capability, Iranian cyber attackers have been masquerading as Hamas cyber hacktivists and doing these attacks. So this is a new thing, and it's increasing aggressively. We have reports from both Microsoft and Google, who can't agree on a lot, but their threat analysis centers can both agree that Iran is ramping up these efforts. They've increased significantly in January and February. And so I think we're going to see more of this over time unless we do something about it.
That's actually really interesting when you think about it, that, of course, Iran has been a patron of Hamas now for, decades. But to essentially take the wheel for cyber attacks in the name of the Qassam Brigades, in the name of the Hamas military wing. That's an interesting thing. We obviously are also holding our breath, waiting to see whether Hamas develops some of its own capabilities. But I think that would be increasingly difficult without a home base to operate from. Another question here for you. You and Annie were quite critical of the U.S. response to Iranian actions over the last several months, maybe even over the last several years. What should we be doing in cyberspace right now, specifically against Iran? In other words, how to counter this? I mean, I'm concerned that there is a weak U.S. response to Iranian actions across the board, but certainly in the maritime realm, specifically in the Red Sea, right?
No, you're absolutely right. So the initial response in cyberspace was even different than the initial October 7th U.S. response. In cyberspace, it was really tepid and slow. But like the U.S. response in other areas after October 7th, it's starting to worsen. So what I mean by that is we should be absolutely defending for it. That's our principle. Our principle is if you attack the United States or its allies or partners, we go forward to attack you on your what's called your cyber infrastructure, the system of networks and servers and such that you launch your attacks from and try to degrade that. We've done that to Russia after the 2018 and 2020, to disrupt their efforts to disrupt our elections pretty successfully. We've done that against some other countries. So we've done that a lot against criminal actors. But it's time to do that against the Iranian systems, and we're really not seeing that. What we have seen are some minor, we indicted six Iranian, intelligence officials for some attacks on our water critical infrastructure. I'm gonna take a guess that the extradition treaty with Iran is not gonna be signed anytime soon, so we're not gonna see any of those six guys. And because it's against small individuals, I don't think they have funds that we can grab in the United States. So from my point of view, I wouldn't call meaningless sanctions, but they're totally unfulfilling sanctions. And then the other thing we've done is a minor attack on a maritime vessel of the Iranians that I think disrupted it for a short period of time. But to me, that those aren't successful. I put this much like what we've done with the IRGC attacks and the Iranian support to the Houthis in the Red Sea, where the attacks are coming from the Houthis, but the problem is the Iranian supply chain. We're not attacking it aggressively to stop the missiles from coming. We're not attacking the Iranians in their cyber infrastructure to stop the attacks from coming. You're not going to stop these things till you punish the Iranians and hold them accountable for what they're doing. Doesn't mean mainland kinetic strikes, but you can do cyber strikes into the mainland, and you can do strikes on the supply lines.
Right. And there's also those two spy ships that are based off the coast of Yemen that are apparently painting some of these vessels with lasers that appear to be enabling the attacks against maritime shipping in the Red Sea. You'd think that at least we'd be targeting those. But it's funny, as you talk about the sanctions and the sort of bureaucratic approach to punishing the Iranians for its cyber activity, it reminds me a lot of actually post 9/11, getting back to that same theme of the war on terror. We threw the book at a whole bunch of different people in the 90s and early 2000s, and then eventually watched as they stepped up their attacks against the U.S. I think it's just a sign that these bureaucratic measures are insufficient and not likely to help with deterrence. A separate question here for you. FBI Director Christopher Wray recently described a significant cybersecurity threat to our U.S. critical infrastructure. Clearly, the number one threat he was describing was China. Maybe he was also referring to Russia, but could Iran be part of this threat to U.S. national security as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So Director Wray, and he was joined at the time by CISA Director Jen Easterly, all our cybersecurity experts, the National Cyber Director, the head of Cyber Command, General Nakasone at the time. And they all came together and said, look, there was a specific attack called Volt Typhoon, which was China installing destructive payloads in our national critical infrastructure, in our port systems, aviation systems, power generation, financial services, things like that, water. These are places where and these payloads aren't active, right? This isn't the normal Chinese behavior of like intellectual property theft or something like that. This is about having a hook into our systems. So at a later date during a crisis or contingency, you might deter us from taking action by having things not work, or during an actual flow of forces, you can disrupt them. All right. So they pointed to China, but they also said afterwards, Director Wray's come out and the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, have come out with their annual reporting and said very clearly, there's three countries that can really do this. China, Russia, who's probably done it the longest, but is distracted by Ukraine and other things right now, and Iran. And Iran, in fact, had recently done a water attack against a series of water water systems. It was a pretty good attack. I mean, this was not, this was not JV ball. Now, what they did in the attack was minor. It was the equivalent of website defacement. It was system interface defacement. But it could have been much more severe, and that's gotten a lot of attention. And so now, what we really see is, look, here's a country that really can't reach out and touch the United States in the homeland, in the United States, Iran. Iran can't do that in any other missionary but cyber. And the Iranians are nothing if not entrepreneurial. And they'll know that. And they're going to work on these systems. And, you know, countries will share tools with them. Criminals will share tools with them. And they will get better and better. So this is a long-term problem for the United States as we continue to confront Iran in both the Middle East, but also in our support for Israel. We can expect to see greater Iranian cyber attacks against the United States.
Okay, so we expect more attacks to come. How should the U.S. be responding to these cyber threats? We talked about Defend Forward, but are there specific things that we can do beyond that if we're not willing to go all the way with kinetic strikes on their homeland? And we don't seem to be interested in even targeting some of those supply chains that you talked about with the Houthis. I mean, where are the vulnerabilities that the U.S. is willing to touch?
You know, so I look at it like three ways, three different types of action. The first is we actually have to work with the owners and operators of our national critical infrastructure. So unlike, say, submarine warfare or cruise missile warfare, where the Department of Defense owns everything, in cyber warfare, 85% of the target set, what the Iranians or Chinese or Russians would attack, is owned and operated by the private sector or state and local governments. So the first thing is, they actually have to invest more in defense. The kind of rule of thumb we use is like 14, a good number is like between 10 and 14% of your IT budget needs to be on cybersecurity. Only major US banks do that. The vast majority of our infrastructure, because they didn't see a threat 10 and 15 years ago, it hasn't been spending on cybersecurity the right way. Now, silver lining to ransomware and all that cyber criminal activity is it's driving that number up. But the number one thing we have to do is actually defend ourselves, invest in cybersecurity. And look, for like utilities, state and local utilities, particularly rural ones, that may require some incentivization from the government, some support and grant programs and things. The second big thing is the government's got to be a better partner. Like the Air Force has no trouble sharing, inbound cruise missile data with the Navy, right? We got that one pretty set. But in cyber, we're not so good at sharing what starts out as classified information with the private sector. So we've got to figure out how to rapidly declassify, push out threat information to the private sector so they can better prepare and defend themselves. And like I said, create some incentivization programs, not for Fortune 500 companies, but for the rest of them, the medium-sized businesses that are important, state and local governments, to make sure they can properly invest. So that's the second thing, is build that better public-private collaboration and the government as a better partner. And the third thing is one you alluded to at the beginning of the question, which is we have to build, increase our offensive capacity. We have a good offensive capability to do cyber attacks. And certainly, we've had some law changes and some presidential decisions that started in the Trump administration, but have been carried on by the Biden administration called National Security Presidential Memorandum 13 that allows us to plan for and execute offensive operations. But we need to do that persistently. I'll give you an example. The Israelis in 2020 were attacked in their water cyber infrastructure by the Iranians. They immediately struck back hard into Iran, taking down systems aggressively. And you saw a step back by the Iranians in their activity against Israel. That's how deterrence works. You impose cost on somebody, and the deterrence by punishment, and they say, hey, the juice isn't worth the squeeze on this, and they back down a little bit. We have not practiced that kind of deterrence.
Yeah, it's actually, it's amazing talking to you guys over at CCTI, just this war that's happening that no one sees. It's fascinating. It really is. And I think it's hard for a lot of people to imagine exactly what's going on quietly behind the scenes, but there's just so much beneath the surface. Last question for you. Later today, you and Representative Mike Gallagher and Columbia professor Erica Borgard will be taking part in an event discussing the possible creation of a dedicated cyber force. Just give us a teaser about what that means.
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, the way we kind of conduct operations is we have U.S. Cyber Command, which, you know, equivalent to say if in Israel, Unit 8200, but it's the way that is how we do what's called the employment of force. U.S. Cyber Command's actually over the last 10 years evolved reasonably well. They know how to apply capacity. They're definitely the most capable offensive cyber force out there. They're not the largest. The Chinese are probably 10 times their size. But you know, they have, you know, the US and Israeli probably have the best capabilities, and then the US has quite a bit more capacity. But even though Israel has a lot of threats, the US has two very big threats in China and Russia. And so we actually have to be significantly bigger. That's called force generation. That's like the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, building forces that they give the Cyber Command. What we've noticed over the last 12 years is that's four very inconsistent, ill-performing, sometimes contradictory force generation efforts. What I mean by contradictory is we'll pay two people doing the exact same job with the same amount of experience, 40, 50% different. That makes half those people pretty unhappy, right? So, you know, the idea is, you know, we've come to the conclusion that the most effective and efficient way to generate force is to have one cyber force. And this isn't like people go, oh, but Mark, there's uniqueness. There isn't. Like, I get it. If I'm going to go blow up a train trestle from a submarine 50 miles at sea, I'm going to look to a Navy SEAL to do it, probably not an Army Ranger, because as they ride that little skidoo in, you know, from James Bond, you know, I want them to not drown. So that's a Navy SEAL job. I get it. But if you're telling me take down that cyber trestle with a cyber attack, it can be an Air Force person, a Navy person, an Army person. I don't care. So really, we need a cyber force. What it'll do is standardize our recruitment, our onboarding, our retention. One thing I want to point out is we have a ton of problems getting the right people in. If you look at Unit 8200 in Israel, they have a great system early on in their education. Through testing, they identify middle school, early high school students for possible inclusion. They go to summer camps. When the draft comes around, they're already picked for 8200. We don't have that kind of system. And you can imagine the ACLU losing their mind over that kind of testing. So, you know, in the United States, we have to go recruit them. And the problem is the U.S. Army is outside the men's football locker room, the women's soccer locker room, recruiting. They're not outside the robotics and the e-gaming rooms. As a result, we're not pulling in the right people to get the right cyber force. So this is a comprehensive argument that I think will take several years. DOD, U.S. Department of Defense is not going to take this sitting down. But they really need a new force generation model. They don't like to be told this by outsiders. So we're gonna talk about that at 11:30 today. And leading off will be Congressman Mike Gallagher, who's been, you know, an NSN fellow. I know a guest of yours before on here, but you know, as someone who has a unique position sitting on as chair of the Cyber Committee and chair of the China Committee, to see that we need change in cyberspace.
Generally, I got to say, a little wary of adding bureaucracy to the U.S. government, but I think you guys make a good case here, and I certainly welcome our viewers and listeners to tune in at 11:30 today. Thank you, Mark Montgomery, for joining us live today on the FDD Morning Brief.
Hey, thank you for having me, John. It was really fun.
Okay, here's what FDD has on tap for you today. FDD's Brad Bowman and John Hardy have a new piece out highlighting why bolstering Ukraine's domestic drone production could provide major benefits to the embattled American ally as it fends off that Russian invasion. My colleagues encourage policymakers in Washington to press our European allies to provide funding for domestic procurement of drones. They also think the U.S. should authorize Kyiv to use some of its forthcoming U.S. assistance to procure select drones for Ukraine. My colleague Bill Roggio from FDD's Long War Journal has released a new episode of his podcast, Generation Jihad, where he shares his thoughts on the House Foreign Affairs Committee's recent hearing on Afghanistan. Bill spent decades tracking the ups and downs of U.S. policy in Afghanistan, and he was one of the most prescient and nonpartisan analysts warning about the Taliban takeover ahead of a U.S. withdrawal. It's always worth hearing him on this topic, as well as others, but he assesses the fallout of the undeniable U.S. failure there, and he also explores what might be learned from the debacle, if we're willing to learn from our mistakes. And last but not least, FDD founder and president Cliff May hosted former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton for another excellent episode of FDD's Foreign Podyssey. They discuss the new world order and the troubling axis of China, Russia, and Iran, a theme that we talk about quite a lot here on the FDD Morning Brief. That is well worth a listen. Certainly encourage you to tune in. Okay, that's it for today. Read our expert analysis on our website, fdd.org. Read our quick takes on X at FDD and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at fdd.org/invest. Have a great weekend, folks, or actually have a great week. Tune in Wednesday for another episode of the FDD Morning Brief featuring Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League. We'll talk about the ways anti-Israel sentiment has created wider challenges in his ongoing battle against anti-Semitism. We'll see you then, I hope. Until then, I'm Jonathan Shanzer, signing off for FDD.